Good morning. It's Saturday, March 22nd, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMM, LP, in Burlington, Vermont. I'm Shayla Shapiro, your host for Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. Write the Book features interviews with authors, poets, illustrators, agents, and editors. Today, you'll hear a conversation with David Huddle. A native of Ivanhoe, Virginia, David Huddle served as an enlisted man in the Army during the Vietnam War. After returning to the U.S., he earned his undergraduate degree from UVA, a master's in English from Hollins College, and an MFA from Columbia. His body of work includes 2 novels, 4 collections of short stories, 6 books of poetry, 2 novellas, many essays, and a textbook on writing. His work has appeared in Esquire, Harper's, The New York Times Magazine, Yankee, Playboy, and Best American Short Stories, not to mention a list much too long to read of smaller distinguished journals. His novel, The Story of a Million Years, was selected Best Book of 1999 by the Los Angeles Times Book Review and named a distinguished first novel by Esquire. In 2002, he won a Pushcart Prize for The Story of the Door. Mr. Huddle has been awarded 2 NEA fellowships and positions on the faculties at Middlebury's Redloaf School of English, Pacific Lutheran's MFA program, and UVM, where he serves as a professor in the Department of English. His latest collection of poetry, Glory River, is due out in April from LSU Press. In February, I spoke to Mr. Huddle at his home in Burlington. I asked him how he came to be a writer.
I guess I came in large part because I grew up in a family that had books all over the house. Grandparents had books in their houses, and reading was a very big deal in our house. And I liked the thing of language on paper between covers. I grew up in a place and time when creative writing was not encouraged, that is, in rural southwestern Virginia. Nobody thought to encourage us to try to make works of literature. So I really didn't receive encouragement in trying to write, or formal encouragement, until I got to the University of Virginia and took a story writing class in my 4th year there. So, then I had a teacher who paid attention to my work and seemed to think that I had something to offer. So that was very encouraging. I should also say that my older brother was a kind of genius of the area, and he liked to write plays, and he did write plays. And so when I was a little boy, I sort of imitated him in writing plays, but I don't think that they were comprehensible or anything like that. I just sort of wanted to sort of sit down and mess with a typewriter, which is probably what I did.
So sibling rivalry can create a lot of art.
Yeah, yeah. It can, and then actually when I started writing stories, this was at the University of Virginia, my brother lived in Charlottesville, he was wonderful as a reader, and he gave me a whole lot of encouragement too. So maybe both those things, having a teacher who was encouraging me and having a brother who was encouraging me.
Now, did your brother go on to write
He didn't. He did write a detective novel. In his, probably when he was in his 50s, he did, and I read it and gave him suggestions and even put him in touch with an agent it never came to a published book. It was pretty interesting, but it wasn't a published book.
Okay. Now, in your book, The David Huddle Reader, you in your introduction, you say the basic task of the artist is to receive, understand, and attempt to realize the instruction of his or her inner life.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if you could talk a little bit more about what you meant by that.
Well, I think I'm talking about what we ordinarily call a creative writer, that is to say a novelist or a poet or a writer of creative nonfiction, in which really what you have to offer are essentially what's inside you, your inner resources, your thoughts and feelings. But I think also a kind of special writer's brand of those, that is your thoughts and feelings as they are articulated while you're trying to write. Mm-hmm. And that often goes, tunnels down into the subconscious life so that you're actually going into territory that you usually have not, you're not all that familiar with. I mean, it's both familiar and strange. And so when you're writing, you're trying to grasp that part of yourself that's just slightly out of reach. And I think when I say receive, I think you have to be in a particular place to do that. Generally speaking, you have to be in a place where you're not going to be bothered, you're at least going to have temporary relief from the usual tasks and chores and phone calls and mm-hmm. emails that you might get. All of that has to be put away. And I think it's a little bit like meditating. It's a little bit like what passes through your mind when you're running or carrying out exercise. And I would say that's the good stuff about it. It's sort of putting to use a part of yourself that you don't use in any other way.
Sometimes you'll hear people interested in writing ask, what's the difference between more commercial writing and more literary mm-hmm. writing? And it sounds like that's part of what you're talking about, that the literary
yes.
writing is perhaps a bit more of an inner exploration?
I think so. I think the literary writer has the freedom to do what he or she wishes to do. You can write whatever you want to because you're probably not going to make much money out of it anyway. I think there are commercial writers who also use the same resource but have a little bit more of an agenda for working the material. I think of Chris Bojadian, who's I think an excellent writer and who must rely on his inner life a great deal. But he's also a wonderful researcher and somebody who's curious about the world and other people and doesn't mind making a lot of effort to find out about subject matter that's outside himself.
Mm-hmm. You've written poetry, short fiction, essays, novellas, novels. I'm curious how often you begin to work on a piece and find that you're wanting to take it into a different form.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how often do you start a poem and then decide this is a short story? Or
mm-hmm. I think I've had a few occasions of that. And I can think of the novella I wrote called Tenorman, which I really did start as a poem, and I wrestled around with it as a poem for quite a while before it became evident to me that it didn't want to be a poem. It really needed to be, you know, a work of fiction. And then as I was working on it, a friend of mine offered me the opportunity to try to write a novella for Chronicle Books, which was taking on a novella series. So actually, and I was probably, I don't know, 10 or 15 pages into it. So that's why it became a novella. And I don't know why I misjudged it that way. I think I've gotten better at judging what the impulses of my material are, and so I don't so often nowadays have that experience of starting it in one form and thinking, oh, it needs to go into another form.
Do you feel that prose gives you more opportunity to develop character?
Oh, yeah. But I also do some character development in my poems, too.
Right, in Glory River, there's quite a lot of character.
Yes.
Presence.
Yes, and I'd say that that comes from having written so much fiction that I often rely on that ability when I write poems.
Mm-hmm. Can you read something from Glory River?
I would love to.
Okay.
I'll read the first poem that one encounters in the book, and it's called Courting. When a man loves a woman in Glory River, she runs like fire if she knows what's good for her. And most don't, we admit that much. Because any boy grows up here gets ugly for his middle name. Our boys don't know how to take a girl to Hester's drive-in and hold her hand, or call her up and tell her she's pretty, or just plant a soft little kiss right below her earlobe. That's not the way we do it. We take her for a ride and jack the truck up to 100, scare a cold sweat out of her, then run a hand up her skirt and get slapped good. Timing's got to be exact. Look at that moon we say in dulcet tones, jerking a thumb, got my guitar in back, thought maybe you'd like to hear some George Jones.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Now the poem that you shared two poems with me before
yes.
we had this talk, and
yes.
one of them had a first-person narrator who seemed to be interviewing the people in the town
mm-hmm.
of Glory River.
Yes, that's right. The mayor of Glory River, that one is called.
Right.
Yes.
Who is that person, and how present is he in the book?
That person is present only in that poem.
Okay.
And you'll recall he's an academic. He's sort of a person who's into Appalachian studies, which is a new, what should I say, a new discipline in probably in literature and sociology and so on, new maybe in the past 10 or 20 years. And so this fellow goes to Glory River and actually finds a kind of gold mine of information and folklore and customs and all that sort of thing. The Glory River is a really backwoods kind of town in Appalachia, and many of the poems have to do with strangers coming into Glory River and doing one thing or another. And in that particular poem, he is treated as a kind of joke, and he sort of tries to take the joke into his work and actually does incorporate it into his work and attains academic success by virtue of what he finds out in Glory River.
And I thought it was very interesting that he felt a little bit like the longer he stayed there, the less likely he would be able to leave.
Yes.
And
yes.
It was that was almost a little sinister.
Yeah. It is. And, you know, I suppose one thing, my position here in Vermont is that I've put a very strong barrier between my life and the life that I would have had if I had stayed in Ivanhoe, Virginia. And I feel, to some extent, that I've really made an escape, you know, from a life that seems to me now very limited, limited in ways that it makes me shudder even to think of them, limited intellectually, artistically, culturally, politically, all sorts of ways. So I think about it from that direction, but then I also think about, you know. I don't have a home, essentially, in the way that many people do. I don't feel the connectedness to Ivanhoe that I think even other people who've gone away feel. I feel a real necessary separation between that place and myself. But I'm afraid I often think, well, you know, David, you could be there right now. You could be eating those pinto beans right now.
Well, that brings me to another question I had, which is... you were raised, as you say, in Virginia, and you've lived in Vermont for a long time. Do you see yourself as a Southern writer?
That's such a difficult question. I would say yes, and I would say that I see myself as a Vermont writer, and an Appalachian writer, and a Vietnam writer, an American writer, all of those things. I have no commitment to any one of those identities, and I feel like anybody would be a sort of a fool to sort of put himself in competition with William Faulkner and Eudora Welty and Flannery O'Connor and Cormac McCarthy and people who are really geniuses of Southern literature. But I've read those people and I've learned from them and I've stolen from them occasionally, so I won't deny my connection to them.
Mm-hmm. You have a story called Poison Oak, in which a character, one of the moments in Poison Oak, a character looks in at his family through a window from outside the house. In another of your stories, The Wedding Storm, the main character imagines looking into the lighted windows and warm rooms in his town. And in your novella, Tenor Man, you deal quite directly with the theme of voyeurism, you know,
mm-hmm.
looking in from the outside. What's private and where can we
yes.
draw the line? But how has looking in from the outside become, it seems to be something of an element in your work?
there's a question. Well, I suppose I would say that many writers are inclined to be transgressors of one sort or another. And probably in my case, it's much better that I be a transgressor of the writing sort, because it essentially means that I don't get arrested for going to people's windows and looking inside their houses. But and I often ask myself, what is it with me that makes me interested? I walk the dog nowadays at night and walk through neighborhoods, and I've even written about walking through neighborhoods of Burlington. And you know, I'm walking past a window and I see people inside, say, sitting at a table and eating. And there's something in me that says, I want to be there. I want to be in that table eating whatever they're eating. And their lives look so attractive to me when I look in like that. And I'm sure that if I knocked on the door and asked to come in and went in and sat for a good 5 minutes, I would want to get away immediately. But there's some part of me that just wants to do that, wants to see what's going on in the house, wants to see the people, what they're doing. And I would say that writing is it's a good thing for me to do. It's a very healthy activity for someone of my inclinations.
In the same story, I just mentioned Poison Oak, two boys drown.
Yes.
And in Latour Dreams of the Wolf Girl, your novel, mm-hmm. there's a secondhand story about two boys drowning.
Yes.
Did that actually happen?
Yes, that happened. And as I have, I think it must have been fifth grade, and they were twins, and they were friends of mine, and it was quite something that, you know, the New River goes through Ivanhoe, Virginia, and it's within seeing distance of my house, especially in the winter. You can look down and see the water in the river, and it's a river of some danger, you know, not huge danger, but people swim in it all the time. But those boys went out in a boat with older boys, and the boat turned over, and they had on, you know, their clothes, and they couldn't swim. They didn't get out. Mm. So during the time when they were being pulled out of the river, I think we heard sirens, and maybe people called us up and told us what had happened. But anyway, I was down there by the river when they were pulled out, and with my mother and father. There's also a poem about it in my first book of poems, Paperboy, which is, gives a much more direct and explicitly detailed account of. Mm.
It's helpful to be a writer when you have things like that in your life. Everybody has things like that in their life. I think that writing must be a
way of dealing with it, a way of purging it, I would say. But in this case, it's interesting to me that some things in my life refuse to be purged, and that's one of them. And I wouldn't be surprised if I don't write yet again about the drowning of those boys.
That's a pretty powerful one.
Yeah.
I want to talk a little bit about Latour Dreams of the Wolf Girl, your novel. Mm-hmm. I think it came out about 5-6 years ago.
Mm-hmm.
You move back and forth in time from 17th century life of Georges de Latour, an artist, an actual artist from history, and the modern day life of an art history professor and her husband mm-hmm. and their world. You also move back and forth through various character voices, mm-hmm. and in neither case with the narrative time and the voices do you necessarily wait for a chapter break to move.
Yes.
And I was curious how you came to structure it that way.
Well, I'm one of those people who sort of has to struggle with that aspect of writing. I think my ability as a writer is mostly in being able to concentrate very hard and to get down into the specific moment of experience, either imagined experience or remembered experience. So, and that's what I do well. That's the strength of my writing. But I don't have the power to write a very long story, let's say a story that would take 300 pages to narrate from beginning to end. I can't start at the beginning and write it straight through all the way to the end. My mind is too fragmented to do that. So when I write novels, I write them in pieces, and I end up throwing away a pretty fair number of the pieces and changing the pieces, and I try them out in different arrangements. And with both of my novels, I had a lot of help from two editors at Houghton Mifflin, and my agent, and my writer friends here, and family members. And so what you see when you read the book is something that has evolved over a long period of time with a lot of help from other people. I think it often looks like that it must be easy. You just put this piece here and that piece there, but it's not easy, and it's not easy in some part out of real stupidity on my part. It takes me a long time to figure out things. For instance, the first chapter of Latour Dreams. No. The first chapter of Story of a Million Years is a story that I published in. Seems to me I must have published it in Story Magazine. It was in Best American Stories and so on. And in the novel, for a long time I insisted that it be the third chapter of the novel. And my agent and editors kept saying, no, it needs to be the first. It needs to be the first. It needs to be. And I said, no. But I finally saw that they were right, and now I'm really glad that I did listen to them. I wish I were a smarter and more capable writer in that regard, but I've come around to understand that for me to publish a book, especially if it's going to be a good book, I need help.
Yeah. Well, now, when you publish with a larger house, like you mentioned Houghton Mifflin, right?
Yeah.
And then you've also published with smaller presses.
Oh, yes, more of the latter than the former.
What's that like? What's the difference?
Well, at Houghton, I'm not sure it's this way at every large house. I do know that nowadays the scuttlebutt is that there aren't many editors who really like to edit in the old sense of the word. When they buy a book, much of what they're looking for is a book that's all finished and all that they just need to send it to the proofreader and it's all done. But that was not the case at Houghton Mifflin. Both Heidi Pittler, who was sort of my immediate editor, and then Janet Silver, who's sort of the boss of the trade division of Houghton Mifflin. Both of them had a lot of say about, and they had no hesitation about going in and doing sentence by sentence work, and also by just sort of saying, no, this chapter won't work, and this chapter won't work, and you need to do something else. So, which caused me great pain. I often spend a lot of time just walking around the house. In a pout, kind of talking to myself and calling them names and all sorts of things before I got reconciled to taking their suggestions and doing the work on it. But I should also say that at smaller houses, I've had excellent editorial responses help. That was true at David Godin with a couple of the editors that I had there. I had three different editors for my three books at David Godin. At several university presses, I've had no help whatsoever. And I really prefer having editorial comment and suggestions. That's a better thing for me.
Okay. You wrote in one of your essays, you wrote, training and luck, a part of which is that I've never made a lot of money with my own writing, have allowed me to give this very personal activity a more and more important place in my daily life. I wanted to ask you if you could talk a little bit about how are writers lucky when they don't necessarily make a lot of money. So many writers, that's their big dream, and it is an elusive one.
Yes, yeah. Well, I was relieved to learn from reading Colm Tóibín's novel about Henry James, a book called The Master, that Henry James came from a very wealthy family and probably never had to work a day in his life. And we think of him as a great master of literature, and I think that probably had the freedom to write as he wished. I think he did make some money with his work, but probably not at first at all. Again, I think of Chris Bojadian, who's a very good writer, but it would make me so anxious. I would worry so much about whether I was writing well enough to make enough money out of my book to live on that I think it would really poison my writing. So with my books and even with my way of writing a book, doing it in pieces and kind of assembling different pieces that are in different points of view and different time frames, all that sort of thing is a very inefficient way to work, and it's one that in which there's no real practical way to go about it. You just sort of have to do it the way a music composer does it, of sort of saying, oh, well, this would go with that and so on. So whatever evolves out of it, it's something that pretty much that, at least in its early drafts, I have completely fashioned for no reason other than just to make something that pleased me and that I thought might please other people. If I had to write to please an audience that would buy my books, I think that would bring out the worst in me. I won't even say what that is, but it wouldn't bring out the good parts of me.
So when you're writing to please yourself, do you think about any of your other readers, even just the people that you know, mm-hmm. as you're writing? Do you think that affects?
I used to deny that. I used to say, no, I never think about audience. No, I just think about the work itself. But I think that's absolutely wrong. I do have a reader, Gita Orth, who was my colleague at the University of Vermont until she retired some years ago, is a reader so essential to me that when I finish something and I think that it can go out into the world, I often will get in the car and drive it out to her house and leave it on her doorstep for her, and she will give me a quick response, and she has the ability to give me the bad news if it is good or if it needs some serious work, in such a way that I can stand it. And she sort of understands, she knows my work well enough to understand it in a context. So she's of great value to me. And I'm sure that when I'm writing, I must have in mind what she's going to think of what I'm writing. Probably I am aware of that, you know, maybe even paragraph by paragraph. In recent times, I've been writing poems with my classes at UVM, my advanced poetry writing classes. I write the same assignments that they write, and we choose those assignments together. So, and I find that very exciting. It gives me a sense of community, of being connected to other people. And another thing it gives me is a sense of readership. When I'm writing those pieces, I think I'm thinking about the people in the class and what they will make of it, how they will receive it. And that is of use to me.
Now, one nice thing about teaching is you have new students each
yes.
semester.
Yes,
one would
that's right.
Now, what about writers who are trying to succeed and are perhaps in writing groups?
Yeah.
And that can be a very valuable thing. But do you feel like a new group of people, sharing work with a new group of people is a good idea on a regular basis?
Well, I guess I would say yes, in the sense that it seems to work for me. And I do think that I do think writing groups are terrific, and I was in a three-person writing group for a long time, and we kept each other going, and that was pretty much how we survived. The thing about a writing group is it has to be pretty much peers, that if you're so much better than everybody in your group, that's not good, and if you're not as good as the other people, that's not good. So there has to be a kind of equality about it. And I think it also needs to be fairly small, or you don't get much attention to individual work. But I think it's a disadvantage to be isolated, and I think you sort of have to figure out how to deal with it, have to be cunning to figure out how to get some writer companionship.
Right. You talked about having revised a story. In one of your essays, you talked a little bit about revision. You mentioned having revised a certain story 25 times.
Yes.
Curious, how deep is that revision? I mean, are you rewriting each story 25 times? Or?
Well, as you know, it varies piece by piece. In some stories, some pieces of writing you can finish up in many fewer than 25, you can finish them up in four or five drafts or something like that. And when you write on the computer, it's hard to keep track of it now. I mean, when I wrote that essay, I think I was still writing the essay on the typewriter. Maybe not. Maybe I wrote the essay on the computer. But that story that I revised 25 times, maybe the reason I remember it so clearly is that I typed it 25 times on the typewriter. So, and that was such manual labor. But nowadays, a great deal of revision just kind of disappears into the innards of the computer. You never see it. It's gone. I'm one of those people who doesn't keep old drafts of things. I am always, I always go with the new change that I have made. So nowadays, I would say that in hard copy, I often will finish stories in fewer than 10 drafts. But I've gone over them again and again and again in the computer. Mm-hmm. And revision doesn't have the same connotation of labor that it used to. You know, when to type the things, then it was really labor to sit down, because you had not only to type the changes, but you had to type all the old sentences that were okay. You had to type them again, too.
Right. Your daughter, Bess, is a writer,
yes.
too.
Yes.
Is she following your path, or is she doing her own?
She's doing her own version of my life. She's a PhD student at the University of Wisconsin, and she's now writing her dissertation. She's just finished the second chapter of it, which is concerned with the work of Sir Francis Bacon. And that's very much a different path from mine. But I think she has written poems on and off while she's been in graduate school, and I think if she has her way, she'll go back to writing poems when she gets a job.
Is she one of your readers?
She is, and she's been a help in lots of things. And not only that, for a while she was one of my sources of stories. She worked for a while as a bartender, and so she heard a lot of really interesting stories that she would tell me, and that some of which found their way into books of mine. I think they're stories of hers stories that came to me from her in both Latour Dreams of the Wolf Girl and in The Story of a Million Years.
We're just about out of time. I have one last question for you, for listeners who are writers. Do you have an exercise or an activity that you can suggest that has helped you in your work when you've perhaps been stuck or unable to move forward on a piece of writing?
This is a very specialized situation, a specialized piece of advice, but there's a long story of mine called The Undesirable that is one of the stronger stories that I've written. And I remember that I was working, I had perfect circumstances for writing it. I was staying out in a cabin by myself. I had all day, no interruptions, nobody bothered me, no telephone calls, nothing whatsoever to do but just to write. And I couldn't get that damn story to work. And I remember writing to Hayden Carruthers. I said, I've got this story I want to tell, and I just can't make it work. And Hayden wrote me back this piece of advice that at the time I got it, I thought, oh, that's just ridiculous. That's of no use whatsoever. He said, well, try one thing and another. And so I don't know. I mean, I didn't take him serious. I thought it was something he hadn't thought about very much. But anyway, I sat down, and what I did, I had been trying to write my way toward an event that had actually happened to me, and I was sure was going to be a part of this story. And it was when I was learning to drive, I would walk out my family's driveway, about a quarter mile driveway, and I would meet my father when he was coming home from work. And on this one day, I was walking out the driveway, and he came into the driveway driving toward me, and he directed the car toward me. And I thought, well, he's going to hit me, you know, and I kind of got scrambled off to the side, and then he stopped the car. And so I was just joking with him. So that was the thing I wanted to get to, and I thought, well, I need a lot of preparation to get to this. And in fact, what I tried was, instead of trying to build up to it, I tried just starting with the thing itself, starting with seeing the car coming at me. And the whole story, once I did that, it was like the whole story opened up. I found that nowadays I'll use the same technique. Sometimes when I want to write something, I think I have to write a little introduction to it, when the fact is I should just start with the thing itself and then go from there. That's my advice.
That's great. And tell me what Hayden Carruth's words were again.
Try one thing and another.
That's wonderful. Well, thank you so much for talking with me.
You're welcome.
And agreeing to
my
do this.
My pleasure.
I hope you enjoyed that conversation with David Huddle. Next week at the same time, tune in again to hear an interview with Douglas Stewart, a literary agent based in New York. Before I sign off, I'll just share with you what I'm calling the Bookworm's calendar for the coming week. On Monday, March 24th at 7 p.m., psychologist Bruce E. Levine will discuss and sign his new book, Surviving America's Depression Epidemic, How to Find Morale, Energy, and Community in a World Gone Crazy, at Barnes & Noble in South Burlington. On Thursday, March 27th, at 7 p.m., the South Burlington Community Library will host a discussion of Edward P. Jones' book, The Known World. On Saturday, March 29th, at 2 p.m., at Phoenix Books and Cafe in Essex, local historian Madeline Holmes will read from her book, Students and Teachers of the New China, 13 Interviews. If you know of an event that might be of interest to writers and readers, email it to me at writethebook@gmail.com. by the Wednesday before the show. Time allowing, I'll include it in the Bookworm's calendar. This has been Write the Book. I'm Shayla Shapiro, and you're listening to The Radiator, 105.9 FM, WOMMLP in Burlington, Vermont. All right.